tuned in to Naturopathic Earth Radio with certified health consultant and former obese child, A. Gregory Luna, where you get the latest on clean living, natural remedies, effective weight loss tips, and sound naturopathic principles from experts and biohackers from around the world and Gregory himself. Don't be a slave to Big Pharma. Break free of the shackles of Big Food and start your journey now to a long, vibrant, purposeful life. Become a citizen of Naturopathic Earth.
Hello, everybody. This is A. Gregory Luna. Of course, you can call me Gregory. And welcome back to another episode of Naturopathic Earth, or NPE Radio. We are very happy that you've returned. And today, we actually have something a little different. I'm actually interviewing a naturopathic doctor, which I'm very excited about. So today, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Yvonne Knighton. And she's going to join us in a second. I'm just going to give you a little bio background on her before we bring her on. So Dr. Yvonne Knighton has worked in healthcare since the age of 17 when she enlisted into the United States Army as an Army combat medic. It was here that she discovered the love of medicine, connecting with people from different places and helping them restore their health. Upon completion of her enlistment, she attended Temple College in Temple, Texas, and pursued a career as a respiratory care practitioner. Dr. Knighton was born and raised in California, but considers Texas her home. Good choice. They say we're the nicest state. Dr. Knighton has been married for 25 years to Tim, a U.S. Army veteran, has two children. Dr. Knighton has a soft spot in her heart for her fellow veterans and their family members after living the life of a military member and spouse for 20 years. So Dr. Knighton, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Great, great, great. She's drinking some white tea. White tea's like the underrated tea no one ever really talks about, right? It's always like green, 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 green.
All teas are good. They're all from the same plant.
Yeah, exactly. So very good. So Dr. Knighton's here to talk about naturopathy. So she is a naturopathic doctor. We're going to talk about, and we do live tea drinking. It's okay to do.
Okay.
We're going to talk about exactly what a naturopathic doctor does, how their paradigm, how their view is a little different than allopathy. Here in Texas, what are some of the restrictions or limitations that they have? And just kind of a fundamental difference between the two views. For example, if you walked into the standard medical doctor, and how would they would approach whatever ailment you have as opposed to how a naturopathic doctor would treat it. And then later on, we'll get to know her a little better, asking her some personal stuff. So Dr. Knighton, feel free to talk about whatever you like, but let's just start with a standard definition of how would you describe naturopathy or naturopathic medicine?
So naturopathic medicine is a holistic approach to health, meaning that we look at the whole person and try to figure out how they got to the state of health that they're in today based on their health journey along the way. I look at their childhood. I look at things that happened to them along the way, traumas, medical issues, any kind of illnesses, things like that. Because oftentimes you'll see that there is a pattern or there's clues in that story that helps me to understand the person that's sitting before me. So I'm not just looking at patient A with rheumatoid arthritis, I'm looking at the person and how they got to this health journey and limitations, factors that are compromising them. And then I try to, then together we talk about what's going to work for them, what is what they're able to accomplish, what they're willing to give up, what they're willing to do. And it really, it's the patient's journey. It's 90% is they're the ones that have to change their diet or their lifestyle or, you know, remove things from their environment that might not be benefiting them in order to support their health. But.
And so, like, how would you view, let's make it really simple. Like, what is your view of pharmaceutical medications? Not you particularly, but as a naturopathic doctor, like a typical NP or ND, how would they view, let's say, pharmaceutical drugs as opposed to maybe a medical doctor?
Okay, so how would a naturopath view Pharmaceuticals. Okay, so in the state of Texas, I cannot take people off of prescriptions, so they have to work through that with their doctor. But my personal view is that Patients often come to me because they want to come off of pharmaceuticals. I feel that sometimes it's necessary, definitely. I wouldn't do anything that would cause a patient any harm. But on the same hand, it's oftentimes, let's talk about diabetes, type 2 diabetes. A lot of times patients can come off those medications very easily by changing their diet and lifestyle.
That's a good point, because I'll bring that up to my high school students. I'd be like, okay, a lot of people in Texas, diabetes is a blight, right?
Sure.
Especially here in South Texas. So I'll bring it up to them. It's like, do you know that you can reverse type 2 diabetes with proper diet, proper nutrition? So, you know, I'll have them raise their hand. I'm like, how many people in your family, or how many people do you know have diabetes in your family? Like 90% of the class raises their hand. And I go, well, you have a choice. You could be taking metformin the rest of your life and still kind of eat garbagey food. Or you could radically change what you eat and make some lifestyle choices, and there's a chance that the diabetes will at least be mitigated, lessened, or if not, go away. So ultimately, it's kind of like, what kind of choice do you want to make?
That's a great point, because with diabetes, it's not just taking the metformin, because the process continues. You may be able to regulate your blood sugar, but I, as a, in the conventional model, I still work in that field and I have my entire life, and I see the process. I see patients that just have diabetes, and then they come in and then they have a little bit of hypertension, and then they may or may not have a heart attack, or maybe they have a couple bypasses. And then after that, they end up with chronic kidney disease. And then after that, they end up with dialysis. And then after that, they end up with a stroke if they make it to that time. So my question is that the path that a person wants to take to kind of live in this almost chronically ill state, or would it be more beneficial to them if they made those very, very simple changes to their diet and lifestyle in order to stop that process and have a completely different dynamic for the rest of their life?
You know? So you're empowering the patient to make the decision. And some people don't. They're like, I still want to drink my beer and eat my cookies, and I'll take the metformin, you know? And,
exactly.
And some will make the choice. But I think a lot of people are just kind of shocked on just diabetes in particular. So the other thing that I used to work at an urgent care clinic, and I would triage all the patients coming in when, you know, they had the respiratory illness or broken bone. I'd be like, how many drugs are you taking? What are your drugs? Mm-hmm. And then I'd be writing them down. And then I'd ask them, okay, what's this drug for? We have to ask them, even though we can tell by the drugs. But lots of times they'll be like, I've been taking this drug for 25 years. My doctor prescribed it to me, you know, 1990. And especially with older people, like they'll give you the list. They literally like have it in their wallet, right? Mm-hmm. Here's my list, make a photocopy. And I think a lots of times they don't even know why they're taking it. And the doctor like never bothers to maybe look at natural remedies, alternative therapies on ways we can treat that condition without the use of drugs.
Right. I think that is definitely a problem in our current healthcare system. Patients a lot of times don't know what their medications are for, and they don't know that the long-term consequences of them as well. So often they're on one medication and then another problem arises as a complication of the medication that they're on. So they get on a second medication and then the list escalates and escalates and escalates. And unfortunately, in a conventional model, most medical doctors only spend about 5 minutes with their patients. With a naturopath, my first visit is about an hour to an hour and a half. So I really get to know the patients. And then there's a lot of education along the way. So we have an opportunity to talk about the medications and the supplements and how maybe a supplement may have less side effects or no side effects as the medication that they're on. So then it's a choice for them, something that they have to speak with their doctor about though.
And you think that limited time is that the typical allopathic doctor is kind of hamstrung by, is that something that you think just came about that way, or is it because they can see more patients in that time? Or do you think they lament the fact that they have such a short amount of time, or is it just kind of like get see the patient? Because when I worked at urgent care, it was kind of like get in, get out.
Yeah, it's partially, I think it's financially driven in some aspects. I don't think that all medical doctors are that way. I honestly don't. I know that there's a lot of good medical doctors that do spend time with their patients, but the model that they're in, they have to see that many patients in order to make the money that they want to make, honestly. Yeah.
Is it because like reimbursements aren't as good as they used to?
And then insurance doesn't pay very much reimbursement for the time that you spend with the patient. So you may bill out $100, but you only get back 20, you know, just depends.
So one of the fundamental differences, as Dr. Knight mentioned, like when you go and see a naturopathic doctor, they're going to spend six, seven times more, you know, as much time than you would with a regular doctor. Because they're looking at the kind of the holistic view of the body. They want to know if you have any food sensitivities. They want to know your past medical history. And I think that's one of the other, the major fundamental differences between the two. Can you think of anything else? I think one of the major ones is perhaps in the allopathic model, it's like medication is like the first choice, right?
Right.
And I think we're wired as Americans because of all the drug commercials that we see. You know, talk to your doctor today for more information about Abilify.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so we automatically go in. I just mentioned Abilify because I jokingly nicknamed that drug Zombilify because my mom at one point was on eight psychotropic drugs. Because it's kind of like what you had mentioned, right? You take one, let's say an antidepressant, and then the side effect is your anxiety. So they're like, let's give you an anxiolytic, and and then you have another side effect. So she eventually was on Abilify, and we called it Zombilify because her mouth was always open, and it was like that. But anyways, you see these commercials, and so whatever ailment that you have, you're already kind of primed when you go in. You're like, well, I saw a commercial for, can you just give me that? And I think maybe one of the fundamental differences is at least in the prevention of disease or the treatment of minor maladies, the allopath, the typical MD, has no problem writing the script for whatever. Whereas probably an ND is going to be a little more hesitant and might look at medications if you lived in a state where you could prescribe them as maybe not the first route, but maybe one of the latter routes.
Exactly. It's like I said, medications sometimes are necessary, and I wouldn't take a patient off a medication that was dangerous for them to be off.
Sure.
And that's always a conversation that we have. But in the long run, a lot of times they can come off a lot of the things that they're on.
And I think the naturopaths will look at, let's say, herbs, botanical and, science, even we got the aromatherapy. We're diffusing peppermint right now, looking at that, and of course, you know, just cleaning up your diet. Because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but most typical medical doctors really aren't trained in nutritional science in medical school.
No, unfortunately, they get about one semester of nutrition in their 4 years of medical school, and naturopaths get about 2 years of nutrition in our schooling. We also get about 2 years of botanical medicine as well. So the beauty about plants is that there are definitely toxic plants, and some of those plants are used, but usually they're in very, very tiny doses, or they are used in a form that is balanced so that if there are any toxic side effects from it, there's something else in the formula that prevents the toxicity.
So you guys get 2 years.
2 years of nutrition,
And why do you think the medical doctor only gets a semester? Is it because Big Pharma essentially is funding the curriculum at the medical school? Because it seems so counterintuitive that part of your job is as a doctor is to treat people, and there's such an intimate connection between what you put in your body and disease. It just seems kind of shocking. And I know really nothing about medical school, but it just seems shocking. Like, why isn't there more on nutritional science in medical school?
Well, the sad thing is that a lot of times the pharmaceutical companies are the ones that are sponsoring the colleges. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
So I mentioned this in my podcast. I mean, I said there's a vested interest in keeping people sick.
Yes, definitely.
Right? Because how can you profit? Can't profit off of people who are disease-free or who are dead. So they want you kind of in that middle ground of chronic disease.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think it's a cynical view of the sick care system, but I mean, it just seems like so commonsensical that medical doctors should be taught more nutritional science and that
they're
not.
And they don't know. Yeah.
And I think it's frustrating because when you go to a doctor and you might say, like, you know, I read somewhere that perhaps if, I'm trying to think of just any example, if I ate more
B vitamins.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It'll help with such and such condition, or let's just like with cancer, I don't want to go off topic with cancer, but my understanding is like sugar fuels the tumors. But if you eat ketogenic or a high fat diet, it kind of cuts off the tumor growth. But if you bring that up to an oncologist, it just seems like the oncologist is either going to get defensive because they haven't heard about it, or they'll call you, you know, Dr. WebMD. You know, you see some doctors that
kind of bully you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they bully you and they browbeat you. If you come in, like, because, you know, a lot of people will go before they go into see their doctor, urgent care, they'll look up the symptoms they're having. And so they'll go in and like, well, I read online. Mm-hmm. And I remember the doctors I used to work with, and they're great guys, but they would always, like, when they would come out of the room, they'd roll their eyes like, oh, I have a Dr. WebMD in there.
Sure.
And I don't know if it's because they don't like to be challenged, because you would think you'd want the patients to be educated. But, you know, on the internet, you can be miseducated.
Sure.
But I just think that there is a nutritional connection to disease. Mm-hmm. And I just wish that perhaps doctors were a little more open-minded, because I think you're hard-pressed to find doctors to say, wow, I've never heard that.
It's got to be research and evidence-based in order for them to subscribe to it. And a lot of times they'll pass you off to a nutritionist, but they're trained in that same model, unfortunately. So a lot of times, even like the American Dietetic Association, the diets that they prescribe, I would never prescribe to a diabetic patient, honestly, because even in the hospital, I'll order trays for patients and they can have so many carbs. I don't even eat that many carbohydrates.
You remember the old food pyramid? The old food pyramid with 6 to 11 servings of grains. And I just thought that was funny because that's just like such a large range. It's like giving a patient a certain amount of cc's of a medication, it's like you can give them 50 to 120 cc's. It seems like such a large range, but yeah, I mean, the old joke about the food pyramid is that the recommendations on the food pyramid will make our bodies look like a food pyramid because it's so grain heavy, it's so sugar heavy. Mm-hmm. And I know they've kind of changed it with the USDA or the FDA food plate and but yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of the nutritionists still have that fat is bad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whole grains are good.
Right.
And, you know, I'll mention it to my students that fat isn't bad and we should try to eat like a low sugar diet. But our generation, and I'm 43, so our generation was kind of raised on buy fat-free milk.
Yes, right? and fake food.
And fake food, right? The Frankenfoods, right? I remember the Entenmann zero-calorie pastries. I don't know if you remember, you can buy those at the store.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the Snackwells, if you remember the Snackwells, right? They're like fat-free.
Oh, right.
And you're like, oh, that's healthy. I'm going to lose weight. You know, we didn't think, well, it's all laced with sugar, just like skim milk, right? You take out the fat, which fills you up and tastes good, and you put in the sugar. So I'm sure that's one of the challenges that you see, especially with the older generation, or maybe even the younger one, that they still view fat as bad, right? Fat makes you fat. Mm-hmm.
One of the stories I have to say is my husband is a nurse, and he used to work in cardiology. He was a cardiac nurse. And for them, telling patients to eat margarine was good, butter was bad. Mm-hmm. I can tell you we had so many arguments about it. I threw away so many tubs of country crock, I can't even tell you.
Yeah.
Because it's fake. It's your body doesn't know what to do with it, so it's just a toxic.
Kind of like Crisco, shortening, even vegetable oils. You know, I think I kind of adhere to kind of a paleo view. I'm not strictly paleo because I mentioned on my podcast, I love naan, you know, I love Middle Eastern Indian bread.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally couldn't live a life of never eating grains.
Mm-hmm.
But I adhere to the kind of the mindset of for cooking, like we should use butter and, you know, lard or avocado oil, coconut oil, maybe.
Yep.
But the vegetable oils that is so ubiquitous and not just cooking, but like in all the packaged foods, you know, you see soybean oil and everything, you see corn oil and everything, canola, it's just everywhere.
So. And those are all genetically modified anyway. So
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I joke about like canola oil, you know, the original name for canola oil was rapeseed oil. Right?
Yeah.
You could see why they wouldn't like that name.
Well, it's exported from Canada. Exactly. They don't eat it. They send it here for us to eat. Yeah,
that's true. It's right. Canadian oil.
All right. So let's go to a quick commercial. Are you feeling anxious, restless? You have some lethargy, you're fatigued. Then try Kate's Apothecary. Kate McCall, my partner here, she makes essential oils, homemade essential oil recipes and blends. She can have them shipped to you and you can get them, and they're all very reasonably priced. So if you're interested in having some homemade essential oil recipes that are not from doTERRA or not from Young Living, just from a mom-pa place, then contact Kate through our website, or you can email her at katemccall@naturopathicearth.com. She made me a nice insomnia blend that I roll on my feet every night and I diffuse, and it's great. It's really helped my insomnia. So give it a try. And now we're back to our interview with Dr. Knighton.
All right, so Dr. Knighton, let's imagine a scenario. If a patient walks into your to your office or standard ND's office, how would their experience differ from that of a standard allopathic big pharma curriculum inculcated medical doctor? We've already talked about some of the differences, but sure. Why don't you flesh out?
Sure. So what I typically do is I have a pretty lengthy intake form which talks about everything from what medications they're on currently, what surgeries they've had, their medical history, how their health was as a child. But I also look at other things like, what are their sleep habits? What is their energy like? Do they have times of day when they feel tired? How is their digestion, their bowel movements, how well they digest food? I also, because I'm also an acupuncturist, I do a Chinese medicine assessment as well. So in my practice, I'm going to be looking at things from both a naturopathic perspective as well as a Chinese medicine perspective. And that's a little bit different. I look at people's tongues. I feel their pulse. In Chinese medicine, you really have six pulses, not just one. And it tells me a little bit about different organ systems and what might be out of balance. And so the interview would be, you know, a lot of just dialogue, talking about what their chief complaints are, how it feels and how it presents, what time of day the problem is worse, you know, just so I can kind of see patterns if there's a time of day when I notice that it's worse, or certain foods that they eat that make it better or worse, or if they have no clue, then that's fine too. And then the quality, if they're having a pain type of condition, what the quality of the pain is. And from a Chinese medicine perspective, I look at different meridians that go through the body. So I kind of, I figure out, well, this is the particular meridian that we need to address. And then from there, I may order testing, a lot of functional medicine testing. Sometimes I'll order food sensitivity testing to see if there's any foods in their diet if that are causing them issues. I can suggest different labs. So when I look at a thyroid test, I don't just look at a TSH. I look at about seven different markers that tell me a little bit more about the thyroid and the adrenals, which are, you know, kind of underrated. It's coming more and more. Adrenal fatigue is coming more and more into the picture, but regular medical, conventional medical doctors don't really prescribe to that unless they're really, really out of whack. And so we talk about that, and then from there, after our testing is back, then we set up a plan. It often
quickly. So with testing, we were talking before we hit recording how the boon of these kind of walk-in labs is really helpful to someone like you, because they can just tell them what tests to have done, and then they can just go in and then the results are
right. So there are some like walk-in labs, direct labs. I use that, anylabtest.com. Anyone can order lab work on there. It doesn't have to be a medical doctor. So because of my licensing restrictions in the state of Texas, I will often refer them to that if I need more detailed labs, or if they have a medical doctor, a primary care doctor that's open to ordering different types of lab work, then sometimes they go there. And so then I see them usually in about 2 weeks after that. We have a complete plan with dietary recommendations, supplement recommendations, lifestyle recommendations. Often I give acupuncture because I think acupuncture is great for anyone. It's a really great way to help balance the body and get rid of stress. And it's kind of a conjunction, something that I can use conjunctively while I'm treating the naturopathic side of it, because the naturopathic side takes sometimes a couple of months before people see really great results, whereas acupuncture, I can see results in 1 to 2 visits. So
here in Texas, I mean, if we lived in California or in Canada, or maybe in Washington State, where naturopathy is kind of like more well-known and more accepted. So when you bring up Chinese medicine or Ayurveda or these kind of alternative treatments, do you get a lot of, I want to say blowback, but do you get resistance because the typical Texan is just like, which is drugs? Or do you think that people who are already coming to you are already kind of predisposed to that, and they're very open to try these weird, you know, herbs from China they've never heard of?
Yeah. Often you'd be surprised. People are usually coming to me because they're desperate, because they've already seen 8 different specialists and nobody's been able to help them. So I'm often not their first doctor that they're coming to. So Once I build the relationship with them and they start to trust me, then they're often open to Chinese herbs. And the herbs that I use are all, anything that I use in my practice, my first mantra is first do no harm to my patients. They're all third party tested to make sure that they're free of contaminants and they contain what they actually say is on the label. So I'm not going to give anybody something that I feel would be harmful to them.
And I'm just speaking out of my own ignorance. So if you prescribed a Chinese herb, where would they get that?
Oh, I have a dispensary that I order the supplements from. Okay. And have them delivered, and they get them in my office.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a tea made with granules of the herbs. So it's kind of, I like that because it's nurturing, tea, having a cup of tea. It's the whole process as opposed to just popping a couple of pills. Mm-hmm. But I have to work with the person's lifestyle. So if they're a busy, busy person, then drinking a cup of tea is not going to work in their schedule. Then we can have the granules encapsulated and they can take those instead. But it's often a combination. It's never just one herb when you do Chinese herbs. It's because, like I said, there may be toxic herbs and some of the herbs may be working on one system and the other herbs might be working on a different system. And so it's the blend of the herbs and the harmony of the herbs that helps to restore the balance in the person. It's like getting acupuncture from the inside out.
Yeah, we're going to talk about acupuncture at the end because mm-hmm. I want to ask you a question about it. But going back to food, mm-hmm. the foods that you mentioned, how you kind of do a checklist of all the foods that are eaten. Let's talk about food sensitivity. That's more common than people think, right? They've kind of like maybe the last 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, like, well, I always get bloated and gassy, and they just think it's normal, and they never make the connection that they could be allergic to dairy or nuts or gluten or...
Sure.
Or even like with the microbiome, I mean, they might have leaky gut syndrome or some type of dysbiosis and they have no idea. And it's mm-hmm. like elimination diet kind of things that perhaps it's something as simple as get out dairy from your diet and
sure.
and they'll notice the symptoms immediately mm-hmm. going away. And they're like, wow,
yeah.
They think you're like a genius, but it's like almost... Because, again, a lot of it is just unfortunate because everybody, including the way we were raised, we were kind of all raised in one way to view things. Mm-hmm. And lots of times with whatever malady you're having, it could be just a minor adjustment or a minor removal of something.
Sure. So let me tell you, I'll tell you what the food sensitivities, a lot of people don't quite understand that. So oftentimes they'll say, well, I went to my doctor and he tested me for... gluten sensitivity and I'm not sensitive to it. Well, when you go to a conventional doctor, they test the immunoglobulin E or IgE reaction. IgE is an immunoglobulin that's released when you have an anaphylactic type of reaction. So that's the kind like people with peanut allergies or allergies to seafood or something like that.
Who pull have out to, the EpiPen.
Exactly. Those are the ones that you need the EpiPen. So the food sensitivity is actually testing the IgA. IgA is in the lining of the gastrointestinal system from the top to the bottom, basically. And that is where a lot of your immune, the first line of defense is. About 75% of your immune system is produced in your gastrointestinal lining. And so IgA is that. So what happens is when you have a food sensitivity and it's a lower level of sensitivity, you may not notice the symptom right away, but maybe 3 days later or a few hours later, you may have a stuffy nose or you may have a headache or you may have some GI symptoms. It can be different for everybody. So it's not always just, oh, I get bloated, although that's a great example. It can be, I have headaches, I have chronic headaches. And then once you figure out that this person has an IgA sensitivity to eggs or wheat or something like that, or it could be something really random, you get rid of that food and voila, the headaches go away and their mental clarity improves and digestive function improves. And that's just one step. So finding out the sensitivity is important, but then the next step would be healing the gut and restoring the gastrointestinal flora. So it is a process, but it's not a difficult test. It's a blood test. It can be a finger prick for a little kid. Mm-hmm. We do that often. It can be a blood test for an adult. And the test that I typically use tests for about 90 different foods, and the most common foods, of course, dairy, wheat, soy, gluten, all of those are in there. And it gives me a graph of the reaction. So some people may have a very, very tiny bit of sensitivity. I don't really worry about that too much. I mostly get rid of the ones that are the higher levels of sensitivity.
One of the sensitivities or food allergies that would just drive me crazy is cacao. I'm a dark chocolate junkie, as my listeners know. And if I ever found out I was allergic to cacao, I think I would go crazy.
Really?
Because I could live without dairy. You know, I pretty much don't eat dairy anymore, but yeah, I love chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So going back to the gut really fast, I think that, you know, there's been a lot more awareness in the, maybe the last decade about the importance of the microbiome.
Mm-hmm.
And how it's so intimately connected to a lot of parts of your body. Like you mentioned, the immune system is connected intimately to it. And I know like serotonin is made in the gut, so mood can be connected to it. But do you want to comment at all on the microbiome or some issues or some just recommendations you have to people? I know that we've talked about kombucha. Dr. Knight makes her own kombucha, which is fantastic. But just talk about how important it is as to have kind of like the, like I mentioned to my high school students, like you have two, it's like a rumble at a park. On one side, you're going to have probiotic bacteria and your immune system fighting for the good. And then you have like pathogenic bugs on the other side. And like, we want this preponderance to be on the good side. We want the good side to always be good, because a lot of people just don't know how important the gut is. You want to talk about that?
Absolutely. So dysbiosis is the term that's given to it. So you can have healthy bacteria in your digestive system, but you may have too much of one of the healthy bacteria.
Really?
And that's not good either. Yeah. So what I will do sometimes is order a stool sample, a stool analysis, but it's not your typical conventional medicine looking for parasites and whatnot. It looks at the microbiome. So it tells me what the bacterial flora count for both the healthy bacteria and if there's any pathogenic bacteria. So I often will order that test if I think somebody has maybe a candida imbalance or if they're having a lot of diarrhea type of symptoms or constipation. And so when I get those results back, it will tell me what the microbiome is. So from there, I use what's called targeted probiotics. So we've heard of probiotics, but if something is out of balance, we fight bacteria with bacteria is basically how I do it. So what I'll use is I'll use botanical medicine typically to help get down the bad guys. So lower the bacterial count of the bad guys.
Like, and what would you use in terms of botanical medicine?
So it's usually a blend of different types of herbs. And I will usually use that supplement. I don't want to name any supplements on the air.
Okay.
But I'll use that supplement in conjunction with the probiotics. So at different times of the clock. So I might use the one that's going to cut down the bacteria or the yeast, we'll say, in the morning, and then I'll use the probiotic at night in order to restore the flora. So that way we get more of the good guys growing and less of the bad guys growing. And then typically that helps. And
like I know like fecal transplants are pretty popular now. Are
you I don't know if they do those in Texas though.
Oh, they don't?
I don't know.
Because I'll mention to my students and they just think it's abhorrently disgusting. Mm-hmm. Like, what? You're putting someone else's poop into somebody else's body? I'm like, well, when you have C. diff, you know, C. diff is very debilitating and can kill you. So it's like either I might die or there's this option.
Mm-hmm.
Where and I tell them it's not like they're going to put a turkey baster.
No, it's encapsulated. Yeah, exactly. You just take the capsules and it goes down. So yeah, that's definitely you'll see that in nursing homes. They'll do that, but I'm not sure what the practice is here in Texas. I haven't heard anybody doing it in this area. But.
So in your diet, in your practice, do you recommend an ingestion of probiotic or fermented foods and prebiotic foods like resistant starch foods?
Sure. Yeah. You mentioned the kombucha. That's something that I try to incorporate into people's diet to eat more fermented foods because I don't want somebody to stay on a probiotic capsule for the rest of their life. That's not my goal. My goal is to restore balance and then teach them how to incorporate the right foods into their diet so that they don't have to be on anything, honestly. Yeah. You should get all of your nutrition from your food. So kombucha is just a great way. It's so easy. It's made with this thing called a symbiotic colony of bacteria in yeast, and it's the cultures that are supposed to be in your digestive system to begin with. It's a tea. It can be green tea, white tea, black tea. It doesn't really matter as long as it's a tea that you ferment it with. You do use a cup of sugar when you when you make the tea, but you let it sit for about 7 to 10 days. And in that time, the sugar is consumed by the probiotic bacteria in yeast, so that at the end you have a very, very low amount of sugar in the kombucha at the end. And it's delicious. I flavor it. Sometimes I'll make mint, I'll do pomegranate, I'll do ginger. Mm. So I make it flavored, and you know, it's just so it tastes good. And it's just kind of one of my hobbies that I do.
Do you ever eat kimchi?
I have had it once or twice, yeah.
It's an acquired taste. Mm-hmm.
I've eaten a lot of interesting things. I went to China and I have no idea what I was eating, but I'm sure it was a lot of fermented foods.
Mm-hmm. I can handle miso. You know, miso is fine, mm-hmm. but kimchi's, it's really, really strong.
Yeah.
It's really strong. So that's great. Let's talk about licensing and naturopathic school. So mm-hmm. why don't you talk about where you went to school? How there is actually a naturopathic medical school that's
yes.
completely separate than here in San Antonio. We have UT Health Science Center, and there's, you know, several medical school, MD schools. So maybe talk about the difference. Where would we find naturopathic medical schools or naturopathic schools, and just talk about that for a little
sure.
while.
Sure. So on my quest to become a naturopathic doctor, that was one of the obstacles, is there aren't any schools in Texas. Mm-hmm. There's only 6 in the United States and 2 in Canada. So those are my choices. And when I started researching, because you, in order to be a naturopathic doctor and an accredited naturopathic doctor, you have to go to one of these schools and take the MPLEX exam, which is like mm-hmm. the same as what a medical doctor would do. So
it's kind of like their board.
Exactly. Board. So you have 2 board exams. You have board exams in your second year of medical school, and then again at the end. And the school that I went to was in Connecticut, mm-hmm. and it was a 4-year university. I had to go there for 4 years. I took all my boards, but it's post-bachelor's degree. I mean, it's the same amount of schooling. Actually, we have more hours than a medical doctor does.
A little trash talk.
We do. I think we had, 50, I don't remember off the top of my head, but anyways, it's a, if you look up the website, the American Association of Naturopathic Physicians, if you Google that, then you can get links to all the different schools. There's a couple in California now. There's mm-hmm. one in Washington State, one in Oregon,
Arizona,
Connecticut, and then since Chicago, I believe there's one.
So Bridgeport's the only one in the East Coast.
One in the East Coast. And the reason I chose that school is because a lot of the other schools are in states where you can prescribe medications. And I knew that in my path, I was going to come back to Texas and work in an unlicensed state. So in Connecticut, they don't have prescription rights. So that was one of my reasons for choosing that school, because I really wanted to learn the grassroots. How do I do naturopathic medicine without prescribing medications? Because I'm not going to be able to do that later on.
It's kind of nice. So you can't fall back on that crutch of drugs. So it
exactly.
kind of makes you more independent.
Exactly. So that was one of the reasons why I chose that school, as well as they had an acupuncture program on site as well. So I did a dual degree. So I have a master's degree in traditional Chinese medicine, along with a doctorate in naturopathic medicine. So I did 2 degrees in 5 years.
Wow. So naturopathic school, so it's 4 years, just like medical school, it's 4 years baccalaureate mm-hmm. and then 4 years medical school.
Yes.
Naturopathic's the same thing, 4 years and then 4 years.
Yes.
The typical MD does a residency after. Right. Is there like a residency equivalent for MDs?
We don't have to have a residency in the states that we're licensed in currently. That might change in the future, but there are voluntary residencies that people can seek. And so Cancer Centers of America, I think, has there's quite a few different organizations that will have residency programs for NDs, as well as there's private residencies as well with other naturopaths.
So it's recommended as soon as you graduate to perhaps do a residency?
I think it would be. My reason for I did not do one is that, A, my age and wanting to move back to my state in Texas and practicing acupuncture. Plus, I have a really strong conventional medicine background as well. So I think a lot of just learning the ins and out of working in a business and working with patients is part of the residency as well. Yeah. Mm. But if there was somebody that I really, really wanted to follow, then I may have pursued that.
Mm. Yeah, I was recently in the Pacific Northwest a couple of weeks ago, and I've been there a few times mm-hmm. when I was younger, but I just miss how beautiful that area is. And I think if I had to move anywhere, as much as I love the balmy winters down here, there's that combination of like water and mountains mm-hmm. and you know, forests that's just so beautiful up there, like in British Columbia and Oregon mm-hmm. and Washington State. So. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about licensing. So down here in Texas, NDs are not recognized currently.
We're not currently licensed in the state of Texas.
So you cannot call yourself a doctor, and you can't call yourself a physician.
I can call myself a doctor because I have a doctorate in naturopathic medicine. Okay. So I can use that term.
But not a medical doctor.
I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a chiropractor. I'm not a physician. I can't use that term at all. No.
Are there pushes here in Texas? Because I mentioned, how many states can naturopathic doctors practice?
There's 19 states currently.
19 states. Mm-hmm. And then most of Canada, I think they can practice.
Canada as well, yes.
Okay, so here in Texas, you can't. So, but there is a push to kind of recognize and kind of legitimize.
Yes, currently there is actually going to be some legislation coming up in Texas, coming before the Senate. The Texas AND is the organization for naturopaths in Texas. So if you go onto their website, you're able to see what they're working towards getting licensure. So hopefully in the next few years, you know, we'll be able to be licensed. The thing with licensing in Texas, for me, it would increase my ability to order testing. Like right now I can't order x-rays, you know, I have to refer people out, and I can't do my full scope of what I learned in school. I have to be kind of careful. I have to work under my acupuncture license for the most part. But I can do a lot, and I don't feel at this point I'm extremely limited. But I think for patients, in order to get insurance to cover it, we have to be licensed. That's the big thing, is that people pay a lot of money for their insurance. And at this point, when they come to see me, I can't take insurance.
So that was one of the questions I was going to ask, is does the typical insurance cover? So they have to pay everything?
Pay out of pocket, yes, for the naturopathic. Acupuncture, there's a couple of insurance companies that will cover acupuncture. And for me, I don't take acupuncture. I mean, I don't take insurance in my practice. I will give them what's called a super bill. It's kind of an itemized receipt that they can submit for a reimbursement on their own.
Great. Okay. So do you think this is going to pass? I mean, is there a big push from the AMA lobby to stop this? Because I imagine that the MDs are not wanting this.
Unfortunately, in Texas, there have been a few malpractice suits from people that we call them undies, because they're not really, they didn't go to naturopathic school. They just kind of did it on their own, called themselves a naturopathic doctor.
Okay.
And so, unfortunately, because of that history, we kind of have a bad stigma against our practice. But that doesn't mean things will change. I think that as more states become licensed, and you as people that are requesting naturopathic medicine, it comes from the people in order to make the change. There's only maybe, let's say, a couple hundred naturopaths in the state of Texas. They're not going to listen to us as much as they're going to listen to all of the people that they serve. Yeah. So
I'm assuming the MDs are not happy about it, because maybe they see you as competition, but I don't see why there can't be a point where NDs are up there with DOs. I mean, DOs are similar to MDs, but they're slightly different. But I just think there's like a complementary kind of system that could work out, where everybody who has a minor malady, chronic issue, can go to a naturopathic doctor. But then when it becomes acute or life-threatening, then definitely go to a medical doctor for surgery. I don't think any ND is like, well, I'm going to cut open this person.
No.
But there is a place, and I just feel like and it's anecdotal, just from like some doctor friends or on Facebook, you know, when I post something on naturopathic and the doctors will comment. And I just think that there's a nice complementary blend that could exist between naturopaths and allopaths.
Right. And I think it's kind of worth going full circle, because NDs were prominent back in the early 1900s. All of the states had NDs, and then those licensings just kind of fell to the MD. So the medical board is what took over. And the state of mind that people had, you know, everybody wanted to see conventional medicine. That was better. They thought that it was better than taking their herbs or changing their diet and lifestyle. So it's really about retraining the brain and the mindset of the people. But they may be to where that malady that they came to me doesn't impact their life every day, and they're able to move on. So we spend more time with our patients. We don't want to spend 5 minutes with our patients. We don't want to do what they do. And again, you know, I've worked in emergency medicine. I'm not going to take on a patient that's actively having a heart attack, they're going to the emergency room. There's plenty of people that we can send their way. And specialists, I still want someone who has kidney problems to see their kidney doctor. I still want someone that has autoimmune problems to see their rheumatologist. But that's just because I want everything to be covered and I want the best for the patient. So
I think maybe the medical establishment, there's three reasons why they're apprehensive about you guys being legitimized. Maybe one, it's the bad lawsuits. So again, there are always bad examples of people that kill people because they're not.
Mm-hmm. And we just get victimized because a few examples of what we do. We don't talk about the millions of people that die every day from medical
right
procedures or errors or medications.
Nosocomial infections in hospitals
exactly.
too. Yeah. So I think that's one reason. Another one, I think they just maybe see it as just a threat to their livelihood, that if we allow naturopaths to practice, that might cut in to their business. I think that's probably another issue. Maybe some of it's just ignorance. How many medical doctors are actually investigating the fundamental tenets of naturopathy and mm-hmm. look up botanical science instead of just thinking, oh, that's just junk. That's just, because a lot of it, again, it goes back to the way they're trained. So hopefully in some halcyon future, some mm-hmm. utopian future, there can be a mixture where people go see naturopaths at the beginning, mm-hmm. but if something escalates or becomes acute or you need surgery or something, then you're going to go down that road. Why can't there be this blend?
And in some states, we can be primary care providers. So I think Washington is one and Oregon is one where we can be, and Arizona, I believe, can be a primary care provider. So they can do that. You can go to your doctor for everything who is a naturopathic doctor. And then if they need to refer out, they refer out just like an MD.
See, that just seems to make so much more sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I think just in closing, I think one of the benefits of a naturopath, of course, if you live in a state where you can see one, an official one, but even in a state like Texas, if you could see Dr. Knighton, it's like there's, to me, at least from my point of view, and I am a little skewed because I do endorse naturopathy, but there just seems to be more weapons in the arsenal of a naturopath. Mm-hmm. A typical allopath, it's pretty much going to be drug, unless it needs surgery or some sort. And they're great at orthopedics, can fix bones. Mm-hmm. But I'm just talking about like family doctor. It's like, okay, it's drugs and, just basic care if it's like a skin issue or something like that. But like naturopaths, you can pull from acupuncture. You mm-hmm. can pull from homeopathy. I know mm-hmm. not all naturopaths, use homeopathy, but homeopathy, you could use botanical science. You could use even, aromatherapy. Mm-hmm. You could use nutrition. It just mm-hmm. seems like you have more weapons to treat
yes.
than the typical medical doctor. And I just think that is the salient point. That's one of the strongest points that should be pushed on why naturopathy should be more widely accepted.
And licensed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Great. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you some questions really fast about acupuncture. And then I wanted to ask you about cupping because I saw on your website, you have a picture of somebody cupping.
Yeah.
Do you cup?
I do.
Is that what it's called? Mm-hmm. Cup? If you cup somebody?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know about it until one of the Olympians, a swimmer.
Michael Phelps.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So what's that?
So cupping is it can be done with plastic cups or glass cups. I typically use glass cups. That's the traditional way. So you light a flame inside of the cup to evacuate the air and the oxygen. So it creates a vacuum and you put it on the person's area that they're having pain in, basically. So what it does is it creates the suction that pulls the blood to the surface and increases circulation to the area so that it can remove any of the toxins, the stagnation that's sitting there bruising. So it helps things recover and heal faster.
So is it mostly used for muscular issues, like muscle tears?
No. It's mostly used for, I will use it in people that have areas of pain that I've done acupuncture on and maybe it hasn't completely cleared. So then I might do cupping in the area, either static cupping where you just leave the cups on and you get like a suction cup mark on it, or I'll do moving cupping where I put a little bit of oil on the skin and I slide the cups along. So it's kind of like a deep tissue massage is kind of what it feels like. There is often a little bit of bruising afterwards and that goes away after a couple of days. But typically after a treatment, the person will feel a lot better after a couple, not exactly initially, but after a couple of days. And then in traditional Chinese medicine, cupping is often used to help in an acute illness. So somebody that comes to me for an upper respiratory infection, there's points on the back that I will use the cups on to help get rid of the, like, you know, when you have like that achy feeling when you have the flu or something like that.
Sure.
So it kind of helps alleviate that and helps improve the immune system, increase the blood flow, and it just helps the healing process.
So it comes from Chinese medicine.
Oh, yeah.
Because I had not heard of it until Michael Phelps brought it to our attention. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if it was like a new fad. Kind of like cryotherapy has been around forever, mm-hmm. you know, sitting in ice baths or jumping in a cold lake. But now you see all the cryotherapy spas everywhere. And,
yeah.
and I know that's kind of like similar. Like a lot of athletes go to mm-hmm. cryotherapy or cryo spas to you know, help speed up healing and so mm-hmm. forth. So
when I was in China, they used a lot of cupping.
A lot of cupping. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you cup.
I do.
Great.
Okay. Not everybody, but when it's needed, I do it.
One of the things that my listeners know is that I have a lot of insomnia issues and I don't take medications for it. I try to, you know, take magnesium and do some good sleep mm-hmm. hygiene, but somebody did tell me that acupuncture is good for insomnia.
Mm-hmm. I have people that come to me for sleep issues, anxiety, depression. A lot of times it's just helping the person be able to relax and balance the sympathetic, parasympathetic system. And they typically will have better sleep, better digestion, all kinds of good stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great. All right. Well, Dr. Knight, where can people reach you? Where can they find you? Mm-hmm.
So I have a website. It is my name, Dr. Yvonne Knighton.com or Dr. My first name, YVONNEKNIGHTON.com. There is a contact form on there. If you want to ask me a question, you can just click on the link and send me your question and I'll respond to you via email. My phone number is area code 210-596-9755. And I'm located in the medical center area between Wurzbach and Medical on 3740 Colony Drive, Suite, lower level 102. And that's all on my website.
And I'll have her website link mm-hmm. on the show notes as well. But yeah, she is located here in San Antonio. So she is more than welcome to help you.
Mm-hmm.
And let's finish the podcast out with some things that flesh out the person. Kate and I do this all the time, mm-hmm. just to talk about like random things, like what's your favorite childhood cereal, stuff like that. But let's just do just regular stuff. Like, what's your favorite snack? Like, what's your go-to snack right now?
Well, I'll say my favorite.
And it doesn't have to be healthy.
I know. It's a healthy junkie snack, I call it. Like when I'm pretty strict with my diet for the most part. I mostly do paleo. And of course, paleo doesn't mean you just eat a bunch of meat. I eat a lot of fruits and vegetables. And I just try to avoid the grains and the dairy and the sugar. So I like this thing called paleo cookie bars. And the recipe's on Paleo Grubs is where I found it.
Okay.
But I brought one here. Do you want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me get it.
So what's in this delectable sweet treat?
It's made with almond flour, coconut oil. It usually has eggs. Today I put chia seeds. Chia seeds are a great omega-3 type of, it's a seed, so you get it from seeds. So what I do is I grind up the seeds, and you can use it instead of eggs for people that have egg sensitivities. But it also provides the oils, which is awesome. It has a little bit of maple syrup, not a lot, some vanilla, baking soda, and then the naughty treat is there's a few chocolate chips in it, but they're dark chocolate. They don't have a lot of sugar in them. So
it's very moist. I guess that's the coconut oil that's making it.
I think the almond flour is a nice substitute when you're doing paleo using the almond flour. It's for some reason it causes a bit more of a rise, I think, than some of the other flours.
One of the articles I wrote was a review of non-wheat flours to mm-hmm. bake in. So do you prefer almond over coconut or?
Well, coconut's a little drying, so you have to use a little bit less of it than what you would if you're doing coconut flour. And often my secret ingredient when something's coming out a little bit too dry is if you blend up an apple in the food processor and stick it in there, it does give it a little bit more moisture.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I'm not the best cooker or cook person. I tell my listeners, like, I'm really good at eggs and yogurt bowls. and smoothies. That's kind of my go-to thing. That's why I have Kate to cook, do all the cooking here. But it's very, very good. And I was joking with Dr. Nutting too. Like, if you ever watch recipe shows, cooking shows, and someone takes the bite, you know, they always say, oh, this is great. But I wish, like, and I tell this to the students, like, I want authenticity. Like, one time someone bites into it and said, this is horrible.
Yeah.
But in fact, this is actually quite delectable. And I'm not lying by any means.
And it's low glycemic index, so people with diabetes can eat it as well. So
I think people are just amazed that there are sweet treats that aren't loaded with sugar. You just have to be creative or just find a paleo recipe. And it's just, there's a lot of great treats that aren't junk, you know?
And this is a nice base because sometimes I'll use it as breakfast bars. You can put some dried blueberries instead of the chocolate chips and some nuts. And then it's just a great breakfast bar. And I'll eat them for breakfast. My kids will eat them. My husband eats them. So.
You mentioned chia seeds. I mentioned to the listeners, I put chia seeds on everything because they don't really have a taste and they have a lot of the MUFAs and they have a lot of fiber too. Yeah. And so I'll put them on my eggs. You can put them on salad. You can put them on sundaes. Some people just put in water and then drink it, but I don't like the water thing.
I do. And I'll use almond milk, chia seeds, and then some type of fruit, maybe some mango and tiny bit of honey if I need it to be a little bit sweet and stick it in the refrigerator. And that's my breakfast the next day. So. It's easy. It's stuff that you can plan ahead, but it doesn't take a long time.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. A lot of those ingredients you just mentioned, I put in my yogurt bowls. I'd like to do like a little symbiotic combo. So I'll do like Greek yogurt and then put a lot of prebiotics in it, like honey and chia seeds. And
you got it.
Unripened bananas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'd say my go-to snack now, I mean, I always push dark chocolate. Like at school, I tell the teachers, like, would you like some dark chocolate? You know, some creepy guy pulling up on a van and opening the door. Would you like some? But right now, trying to think, baklava. I made a homemade baklava, and baklava is sweet. It's sweet, but it's nice because when you think about it, it's just phyllo dough, but it's all nuts and honey.
Yeah.
So it's pretty healthy, and I mean it does have a certain amount of honey, but compared to, let's say, you know, like cake, it's just a really good treat. And if you make it well, and I think the one or two times I made it wasn't that good, but I mean it's good enough to eat, and I really like that.
And often I'll just decrease the amount of if something calls for sugar, and I'm making it for other people. Like when I do it for myself, I have a different palate. I mean, I can tolerate something that doesn't taste really, really awesome. But when I'm making stuff for guests, I usually will, if it has sugar in it, I might put half the amount of sugar. You just don't need as much sugar as what it says.
I've noticed that, like, anecdotally, when I went to Europe, like, if you eat their candy bars, they're just not as sweet as American
ones.
Yeah,
it's too much.
And it's just a lot more subtle. Not just dark chocolate, but just if you eat a regular Cadbury, it doesn't taste as sweet.
I love dark chocolate with sometimes a little bit of sun butter because, you know, it's like a Reese's peanut butter cup.
See, I don't use sun butter, but we have a lot of peanut butter and almond butter, and I'll literally just get my dark chocolate and just scoop up the almond butter or peanut butter and just eat it. It's divine. That combination is
it's so satisfying. And the fat is what really satisfies it.
It's all fat, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it doesn't have any of the preservatives. If you buy a peanut butter cup, it's probably been made like 7 months ago. And
probably.
It's just, you know, all the preservatives are keeping it fresh. Mm-hmm. Last thing, what's your favorite hobby right now? What's your go-to hobby?
Oh, I love, my husband and I, when we first met, we started scuba diving and we got certified together. So we like to scuba dive. We don't get to go very often, but when we do, it's just awesome. It's nice. It's almost meditative when you're underneath the water and looking at how the ocean underneath the water relates to the earth. I look a lot at the corals and the fish and just how it's just so beautiful and peaceful under there. So, and you get to go a lot of fun places too. So the last time when we just recently got back from a trip to St. Thomas and went scuba diving out there, it was lovely.
Yeah. I have to admit that I've never got scuba diving.
You've never gone scuba diving?
I wish I have. Snorkeling is like the greatest extent of my underwater swimming.
It's so different. Yeah. It's a little scary, but you know, you have to get out of your head and be like, I'm not going to get eaten by a shark. I'm not going to get eaten by a shark.
Does it take time to get used to the breathing through the mask?
Yeah, just a little bit. I'm a very relaxed diver. My husband he tends to use up all of his air very quickly. So then he feeds off of mine, but it doesn't take too long. I feel like it's so relaxing and
I bet.
And it's just, you know, you can't see fish in their native environment every day, you know?
The one thing I remember at scuba, it stands for self-contained underwater breathing apparatus. And the only reason is I'm a creature of the 80s. And I remember the TV show Family Ties with Michael J. Fox. And there was an episode where he was going to be on an academic challenge competition, and the other guy got sick, so he had to train Mallory, his kind of dim-witted sister, mm-hmm. all the stats. And so one of the things he was testing was like, what's scuba stand for? And she finally remembered it, and they were all fat, happy, and dancing and all that. But yeah, so that's just my 80s reference. Awesome. All right. So we appreciate you guys listening today, and take care. God bless. And until next time, see you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Naturopathic Earth Radio. Visit us at www.naturopathicearth.com. Follow us on Twitter at Naturopath Earth. And subscribe to us on iTunes. Don't forget to leave a review. And remember our core belief at naturopathicearth.com. Let food be thy medicine, let nature be thy healer. See you next time. Music courtesy of Art of Escapism.